Hello and welcome to episode 140 of The Creighton Crowbar. It is the 10th of May, 2016. My name's Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Tom Francis.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
How are you, gentlemen?
Very well, thank you, Chris.
Pretty good.
It's 2016, but 100 years ago, it was 1916. So what would you naturally call a new game in a franchise set at that time, which previously has multiple times used the year of the war that it's set in as a key part of the title of the game?
Maybe they forgot the other numbers.
Maybe they did. I'm of course referring to Battlefield 1.
I was so angry when I found out it was called that. I've kind of got over it now, but I just kind of flipped out for about 5 minutes. What the fuck? You just think about what you've done.
Yeah. It is. There's something, I feel the same way that I did when they, when they had the conference where they announced the Xbox One. I was on a trip actually. It was Bethesda's pre E3 showcase where they took a whole bunch of journalists out into the countryside and shot them, and showed them pictures of games they'd be talking about E3 that year. So it's like Wolfenstein and Evil Within. It was that year. And so that meant that I watched it in a big room full of games journalists and we were all ready for that announcement because everyone was expecting, I don't know, the Xbox 720, the Xbox
Neo,
just Xbox, That's So Xbox, whatever they were going to call it. And then when they announced that it was called the Xbox One, everyone laughed immediately, like without prompting and without maybe just feeding off each other or like being snarky. It was funny because it was so stupid.
I feel like every time someone does something like this, they sort of, after they say it, they like, I just imagine the executives just like looking at you in the eye, daring you to say it's not the first one. Wasn't that already?
Because the first one was Battlefield 1942.
Mm.
And then
it's the same with Hitman. Like, I'm annoyed that Hitman is called Hitman, but there hasn't technically been another game called Hitman.
Yeah,
but it's still fucking
annoying. If it was called Hitman 1, it would be really stupid.
Yeah, at first I was more annoyed that Battlefield 1 was called Battlefield 1 than I was that Hitman is called Hitman and Tomb Raider is called Tomb Raider and Doom is called Doom. But on reflection, actually, it's more confusing when it doesn't have the number because Battlefield 1 is at least specific and there isn't another one called that. So at least when I say Battlefield 1, you know which one I'm talking about. Whereas when I say Hitman, you just don't know.
It took me a while to realize that what they were getting at was World War 1.
Mm. Yeah.
So
it could have been like a numeral.
Yeah. And so that's what I was going to say. Like having a numeral.
Battlefield
I would have been, I think, a bit clearer with what they were getting at.
Could have called it Battle War 1. That's much closer to World War 1.
Warfield.
World Field 1. Remove all mention of conflict from it.
So yeah, so it's a new Battlefield game. It'll be out later this year, and it is set in a very romanticized version of World War One. It feels like we're watching history that until relatively recently it was, you know, living memory turn into fantasy in the way that ancient warfare and any other, well, anything out of recent memory turns into fantasy. So interesting. I don't think I've seen that hyper glossy men in capes running through clouds of mustard gas take on that war before.
Yeah, it was very, I felt like that trailer was very carefully put together to sort of fight against any preconception of this being like muddy fields and trenches and sort of just suffering, which is probably closer to the truth. So it's like, bright deserts and biplanes and open cockpits and just a very wide diversity of different scenes. Just say, not just trenches, but also here's a trench club.
Yeah, here's a man killing another man with a spade in a trench. I find it interesting because I think maybe we're just more used to big sort of explosive pop culture takes on World War II, where, you know, and everything about World War II, the equipment and the nationalities involved and how people dressed and fought and all that kind of stuff has been adopted into pop culture a lot more substantially. So that, you know, Nazi imagery is still shorthand for villains in everything from whether it's literally Nazis or the Empire in Star Wars or anything else. Like it's filtered into popular consciousness in that way. And it's also remembered as probably the last war with a relatively clear moral line between the people involved. I mean, a World War One game is a lot less clear. And also it's generally remembered, you know, World War One is more often remembered as just a catastrophe of everybody involved. And specifically the thing this game is about, which is the birth of modern warfare and industrialized warfare, it's most often presented as a complete calamity, right? Like it's very rare that you see people going, the invention of the machine gun and the way that it annihilated cavalry was awesome, right? That take on it is not what is really in the popular consciousness.
But coming this October. Yeah.
And so that was the strange thing for me about seeing a presentation or seeing these press releases about like, we're bringing the thrill of the dawn of modern warfare to gamers. And it's like, I'm not saying that's any more or less hypocritical than any other game made about a real war, necessarily. Mm. It's just, it feels more at odds with how that war is traditionally portrayed than, say, World War II.
I think they've done just enough to make it so batshit that it probably won't be too kind of grim and awful as you're playing it to actually think, oh God, real people died in this thing.
Yeah, it's hard to know whether that's more acceptable or less acceptable. It's like, should you be true to the suffering, or is it better to just not even tempt it and stay and just sort of be honest about it being glossy and... Mm.
And it's, I genuinely don't know how much of that way of presenting World War One is specific to this country, like to England or to Britain. Like, because my associations with that war are like Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, and the whole thing being a disaster, and like the image of General Haig just trying to push his drinks cabinet across Europe, kind of, and you know, mismanagement and tragedy and mass death and all this stuff.
And like, just gas warfare.
Yeah,
I mean that's the thing that probably bothers me the most, if that gas is going to be a mechanic in this.
But it suggests it in the trailer, isn't it?
Yeah, because there's like you put a gas mask on, and it's clearly there might be an element of gassing a trench before you go in, etc. And that, like, you read accounts of that, and it was fucking horrible. It's just an awful, awful way to die. And I know it's just big, silly video games, but, you know, it's tough when you're actually turning that into a thing that makes people laugh.
Yeah, particularly, like, I'm never going to see an image of World War One era soldiers dying in a cloud of mustard gas and not think about Wilfred Owen.
Mm.
And, like, you know, the dawn of popular anti-war sentiment in that way, you have like people at the time writing about, you know, the sort of that war was such a death of innocence, in the idea that was when people really stopped holding on to any shred of belief that war was kind of radical, you know what I mean? Like, you weren't going to put on a pennant and get on a big horse and ride into battle and be a hero. You were going to be told that, you know, the last line of the poem, it's a beautiful and fitting thing to die for one's country. And then you were just going to choke on your own, you know, lung fluid in a trench somewhere. Like, having gone full circle, I don't know, there's something kind of weird about it.
It's interesting. I think you're right that World War II has kind of been pulpified by pop culture to the extent that it's kind of fine now. The historical reality and historical accounts kind of exist separately from the silly pop versions. But maybe you'd argue that there's no reason why things like Battlefield can't do the same for the First World War and just kind of create such a crazy alternative reality thing that kind of appropriates the cool biplanes and the apparently capes into a separate kind of pop culture entity that it doesn't necessarily comment on the war.
I certainly, that's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think it's more hypocritical than any other take. I just think it's not protected by precedent in the same way.
Yeah, quite right.
Like, you know, the wave of Call of Duty as a series really started because people were like, man, you know, Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan, how do we make the video game of that?
Mm.
And therefore you get the original Call of Duty World War II games, and you get Battlefield 1942 out of much the same kind of renewed interest in World War II. And that led to decades of games, a decade of games where every other first-person shooter was a World War II first-person shooter. And therefore, maybe it's simply that people got desensitized, but they'd been previously desensitized by their legacy of war films and loads of material. Whereas if you think about the legacy of World War One in pop culture in this country, it's poetry. And if you're not aware of the poetry, it's Blackadder. Like, you know, if you're thinking about it and, you know, Warhorse, I'm trying to think of it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think, like, you know, where is the World War One Dam Busters that's been sitting in cinematic history for 50 years percolating? Because it hasn't.
It's almost as though, because World War II developed a different type of propaganda, a type of propaganda that syncs up well with modern media. And that simply didn't exist in the same way with World War One. So there wasn't that kind of the messages of World War One, the kind of themes weren't, there weren't these PR themes that people could latch onto of like good versus bad in the same way that you could with World War Two.
Yeah.
And, I think that's a part of a propaganda construct from the Second World War that didn't exist for the first.
I think it's arguably also easier to construct in the Second World War after the fact because the narrative of the Axis and the Allies has much clearer lines in it than the First World War, which is a giant mess and a generation of young people being told you're going to go off on a glorious adventure. And it'll last 6 months. Like, the things people remember are the whole, things like, it'll all be over by Christmas.
Yeah.
Like, the enduring cultural memory of that war is like a giant fuck up that completely defined the future of the 20th century and subsequently the rest of, you know, I guess Western society is basically defined on a series of shit decisions and the way that war changed subsequently to match them.
Yeah.
I watched a recording of the announcement on Twitch, because it was like a live stream that they've been building up for the whole day. And 500,000 people were on there in chat. And the recording has the chat feed on it.
Mm.
So it's just like how people reacted basically when it was announced. And for a while, it was quite nice to watch it, because I watched the trailer and I was interested to see what they're doing, but I didn't really care and it didn't have any effect on me. But obviously these are like the most hardcore Battlefield fans who've just been waiting for this thing, and to find out what it is, because they didn't know. And, as soon as it starts, everyone's like typing. There's a bunch of like, sort of, like, standard Twitch phrases that people roll out whenever anything's affecting them emotionally. One of them is ruined. They just say ruined over and over again.
That's based on the Bob Ross thing, I believe.
So that came out a lot, and, people were just saying, oh my God, oh my God. And then like, within sort of like 10 seconds or the first thing you see, someone had said World War One, and then everyone's just saying World War One, World War One, World War One again and again. And it was quite fun to see like people who were really excited about it and kind of sharing a little bit of their excitement. And then about sort of, I don't know, halfway through, somebody says, COD RIP, as in Call of Duty, rest in peace. And, oh, sorry, RIP COD. And then as soon as one person says that, it just like, there's a sort of gap of like, half a second, and then a bunch of other people say it, and then just the rest of the stream is just ripcord, 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 and it just, all that excitement just turns into like bitterness and anger, and they're all just like gleeful that they think this other thing is going to be destroyed. Those other people who like that other thing that's slightly different to our thing, they're fucking in the dust now, we hate them.
As somebody who spends a lot of working day pottering through stuff with whatever Dota is on at the time, competitive Dota is on, the hostility of Twitch chat, or the way it frames positivity, is kind of amazing. Because if one team's doing well, you won't see, good man, that team's great. You'll see, God, the people they're playing fucking suck. And then it'll flip the other way the moment the other team in the same match starts to do well. Like, it's interesting. Twitch's ability to frame everything is hostile. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what they do with it. Like, I was talking to PC Gamer art editor John Strike about it this morning because we were walking to work, and because he's the most hardcore Battlefield fan on earth, as far as I can tell, has played it every day of his life for the last, as long as the series has existed, I think. And I think he perceives it now as a sort of a competitive entity, as a game that has certain mechanics that sort of define what Battlefield is, regardless of if it's, you know, Battlefield in the future, Battlefield in the present, Battlefield with criminals or whatever it has done recently. And like, the big one is like, infantry combat is defined by defibrillators and the resurrect mechanic and the way you manage that as part of a team of people. And, you know, so how they're going to do that. So like, it'll be interesting to see if it's a big change.
Stiff whiskey.
Yeah, exactly.
And a pat on the back.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Like, a firm slap across the face. Like, one person in each squadron can play General Haig. And just, yeah.
He was talking about, I was asking him about it as well, and he talked about sniper rifles, which didn't exist in any way that we would recognize then. But what's a Battlefield game without snipers?
Yeah. Man, what a quid.
Yeah.
But I'm actually, apart from the interesting kind of, stuff around doing a World War One game, I'm actually really excited about playing it. Because I've wanted to love Battlefield again since Battlefield 3, which I got into. I hated Battlefield 4. And if they can kind of strip it down and, you know, change it up and bring back a lot of the kind of simplicity of the earlier Battlefields.
Yeah. The setting solves a lot of problems for them. Like, planes make sense in that context. Sure. Slow, low flying biplanes make sense in a way that jet fighters never will.
And surely you'll be able to headshot people in the cockpits as well. Yeah, and presumably. Create those kind of skill shot moments that Battlefield, I mean, surely, I don't know that for a fact. But
I hope you can stand on the wings, because that's a key part of Battlefield.
Horses, yeah. Horses. Interesting challenge for... I mean,
that's what I should have called it, Battlefield Horses.
Yeah. I can't imagine how horses could work in it. Like, you just shoot the horses, don't you? And then, what, do you get 50 points?
Maybe the horses are really
well, given that this is the war that ended the use of horses.
Yeah, maybe just...
Except it's like...
I choose the horse class.
Yeah, and you're hard countered by the dawn of modern warfare. there should be one class. You know, make it an educational game. It'll teach people through experience. You have one class, which is like the kind of like, I don't know, turn of the century dragoon. Hmm. And you're just a man in a bright red outfit
horse
with like a pointy helmet and a saber.
Yeah.
And like a shit gun. And you're the worst class in the game. You're fucked from the beginning the game starts because you're either going to get killed by a tank, killed by a machine gun emplacement, killed by a man you can't see because he's dressed like the ground, which is a new concept.
Yeah, yeah.
And then eventually everyone stops playing it and lets out this collective, oh.
No, wait a minute.
This is why that happened. Yeah. It's happening. Speaking of, I'm going to do another one of these segues. Speaking of war being on.
A dawn of a...
Yeah, speaking of the dawn of war.
We'll get there.
You saw the Warhammer.
I saw the Warhammer. I did. I missed the pod last week, even though it was just after the Warhammer, Dawn of War 3 news had broken. But I went out to Relic to see it. I think I was the first person to see it. And they were really excited and scared in the way the developers tend to be when they're showing you the thing for the first time. I always say that it's a privilege to kind of see a thing that loads of people have spent years making and be the first one to see it.
Do you like Tut?
I never quite know how much kind of feedback, like how much kind of, I try and keep like quite a stoic expression because I don't want to kind of, you know, I don't want to impress them or, I don't know, it's a weird kind of position to be.
I've done that and I've been told afterwards that, oh, we thought you didn't like it.
Yeah, I've been,
but it's because I've been studiously like going like,
I think I basically kept poker face. Except in a few cases where it's just so exciting, I couldn't pretend. I'm not going to say that, like, this is interesting. This is fucking amazing. Mm.
Yeah, there were a couple of times I just had a big stupid grin on my face in the Dawn of War 3. Because everyone in the room, there's like loads of people in the room when they show press the first time. There's like PR in the room, there's like loads of developers, maybe game directors in there. And they're all watching your expression and as you're watching the thing. But in Dawn of War 3, there were moments that I was just had a big stupid smiley face on when, particularly with the Imperial Knights, which is their like part of their new kind of giant units that they're bringing to Dawn of War, and that's kind of one of the newer things they've done. They used to have big kind of Carnifexes and stuff, but nothing like the Imperial Knight, which is the size of a building and has like loads of Gatling guns and flamethrowers and loads of micro abilities that wreck stuff.
And that goes like a hero or sort of like
elite, so that they're. I don't know. I didn't listen to the last podcast, so I'm not sure.
So we sort of touched on this. Like, I tried to paraphrase things you'd told me. So it might be a good idea to just run up through, like, the way it's different to both other games. So what we're talking about was that it's neither Dawn of War 1 nor Dawn of War 2.
Mm.
It's another change for that series.
It's a kind of hybrid. The Dawn of War 1 stuff is kind of all there intact in Dawn of War 3. So you build bases and you build line units and that all works as it did in Dawn of War 1. You go out and capture requisition points, you build energy things, and that gives you the resources to build Space Marines and Devastators and Eldar Guardians and Howling Banshees. So all of that is just Dawn of War 1, just works in a very similar way, similar squad sizes. And they also, in the same way as Dawn of War 1, have upgrades that you can select. So Space Marines can, for a certain amount of requisition, get flamers, or they can get plasma guns, and they become like a flamer Space Marine unit or a plasma Space Marine unit.
And can you do the old reinforce thing, where like when they lose a guy, a new guy just teleports in?
I'm not sure, actually.
That was always pretty weird. I mean, it like worked from a like game balance point of view, but it kind of felt strange to be losing dudes and then they're just sort of like replenished. Through magic.
Yeah, Relic have kind of, they've explored the reinforced stuff quite extensively throughout both Company of Heroes and Dawn of War series. So there was a point in, I think Dawn of War 2, where drop pods could reinforce squads if the squads were near it. in Company of Heroes, you had little cars that you could drive up, or little points you could put down it out in the battlefield, and then you could set it as a rally point, and people would fall back to it, and you could reinforce from there.
Oh yeah,
I'm not sure how it will work for Dawn of War 3 yet.
Yeah, that makes more sense. I think there was something about the way it worked in Dawn of War 1 where the sort of the fact that you'd just be moving them around the map, and that just new guys would be teleporting in.
Yeah, this just a bit like weird. Amoebas.
Yeah, those. So I'm trying to remember, in Dawn of War 1, you never really made like a second base, did you? You had the, you have your HQ and you build a bunch of like utility buildings around that to support new troops and stuff. And then you go out into the field and you capture requisition points, and then you can fortify those and you build stuff on top of them, but you don't really ever set up like a new base there the way you're doing.
Yeah, you never build second bases in Relic games. Mm. The only thing that can happen is that you move bases. So for example, a couple of heroes.
Oh yeah, Necrons could just float their fucking death pyramid. Yeah.
And that's actually kind of hilariously, like in Company of Heroes, some of the, for example, the British bases were just buses that they built sandbags around, basically. Awesome. And you could just get rid of the sandbags and then just drive the bus up and plant it somewhere else. So you'd move your base in that way. So
British were the Necrons of World War II in many ways.
No, they weren't. In Dawn of War 3, I can't imagine them changing up on that because they've been so consistent.
They've announced Space Marines, Orcs and Eldar, right?
Yes.
And in the stuff you saw, that was just those three races fighting each other, was it?
All I saw was the Space Marines fighting a huge amount of underpowered Eldar, which they deliberately nerfed so they could show me how cool the Space Marines were.
Fair enough. I'm just wondering like if there's going to be a big bad that are all semi-united against.
So, yeah,
and
definitely.
If so, like, it would just be great if it wasn't Chaos. Like, it would be fine for Chaos to be in there.
I think it might be Necrons.
But yeah, that's what I really hope.
I think it might be Necrons. Awesome it because, not because of anything specifically they said, but they said, okay, so all these three factions are converging on a single planet because there's some sort of secret super weapon thing there they all want to discover. And you've got to think of the Warhammer 40k universe. Like, that's not going to be a gun or it's going to be a race of either Chaos or Necrons or something evil. And, but when I went into the room, and I don't want to read too much into this, like, cause they
there was a skeleton.
There was a live Necron in the corner of the room.
This is a pyramid floating. When they picked me up from the airport in a pyramid.
I thought, something strange about this. They set up a diorama of kind of warring races. And on one side there was, Space Marines. On the other side there were Necrons. And Necrons were not mentioned at all throughout the entire presentation, but they'd set up a diorama with Necrons in it.
As in actual Warhammer
actual miniatures that were painted on a kind of board just in front of the table where we were watching the demonstration.
Mm.
And I don't know, it could have just been that they like painting Necrons. And who doesn't? Because they're fucking easy to paint. Just dry brush that shit.
I really like them I love playing as them in Dawn of War 1's expansion packs. And I kind of like them fictionally. I don't know that much about them. I haven't like read into the lore a huge amount, but
it's dumb. I can give you some lore about them.
But the thing I heard was that just, so for one thing, like in the Dawn of War game that I've been in, you, instead of like teleporting new units in, they just like come up from the ground
they've
and you
always
can
existed.
Raise them. And their way of getting into the battlefield is they've always been there.
Yeah, that's right.
Just under the soil. And the reason they want to kill everyone is just cause, they just want everything to be quiet. They just find organic life just really noisy and irritating, and they just want it all to shut up.
That's pretty much all the lore you need.
I can relate to that.
Yeah. They're kind of terrifying. They've got their kind of flying scarab units and everything. They are, I think they were part of the Soulstorm expansion that they were added in Dawn of War 1 with the Sisters of Battle?
I think that might have been Dark Crusade actually, because Soulstorm added Dark Sisters Elder. Of Battle and Dark Eldar, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think Dark Crusade must have added, Necrons and Tau.
Yeah, that makes sense. Necron are, they used to be crazy overpowered because they're basically invincible.
Yeah.
Can't be destroyed. And they exist everywhere and could be woken up at any time.
But that makes them a good bad guy.
Which makes them a fantastic kind of Borg-like threat if you're going to do a campaign twist. So, that pure speculation, but I imagine that's where that would be going. But I guess going back to what the big changes are in Dawn of War 3, so the lining and stuff that all works like Dawn of War 1, is the elite layer that is the bit that's really changed, and that's where they're bringing in Dawn of War 2 style heroes with lots of kind of micro abilities and who are extremely powerful and can fuck up entire units. Those are the elites, and an elite can be a general like Gabriel Angelos, or it could be a super huge unit like the Imperial Knight or it could be like a really cool squad, like Assault Terminators, like one of the elite suits. It could be any of that sort of thing.
That's cool.
And they can all, in the campaign, which flicks between all races, say the missions go from like, for example, Space Marine to Orc to Eldar to Space Marine to Orc to Eldar and cycle that way. Over the course of those missions, all of those units, any elite could be leveled up, and that unlocks new skills and new ways to kind of build them. So, which has a kind of Last Standing element to it across the, across the entire campaign. And, that, so for example, you could do that with Assault Terminators. You could also do that with Imperial Knight or with a General. So you have lots of different types of unit with lots of different kind of growth patterns.
So Dawn of War 2, when you level up your heroes, you kind of, I can't remember exactly when the skills unlocked, but you sort of pump loads and loads of points into your health, I guess, damage and energy. And then in Retribution, they improved it loads so that I think like every point you put into those abilities also unlocked a skill or improved a skill in some way. And leveling up heroes in Retribution was just awesome. There was just so many cool abilities they had, and it was so fun just to figure out what your build was going to be and how you could balance the different upgrades. Did you actually get to see kind of how they level up?
No, they were very coy about that, actually. I think they're still kind of working that out. Or if they know, they don't want to kind of make it public because either they want to reveal it in the future or they might change it.
Yeah. So I have a lot of faith in them in that. I think they're really good at
leveling
up systems.
They're really, really good at that. They wouldn't say, it sounded like it would be ability-based rather than just stat-based. They've moved away from just pumping stuff into health points completely since then. They've never ever done anything like that since. So I'd be optimistic about the upgrades being straight-up abilities that you would choose to slot into a character.
Did you play Dawn of War? Did you complete Dawn of War 2?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I reviewed it, so I played it all the way through, and the sort of the second half or maybe the last third or something got into a really weird thing where I played every map already and it just gives you the same maps again. You have basically the same squad. You're not really unlocking new abilities. Mm. And I kind of, you know, I criticize it for this in my review. It kind of becomes the same fight again and again and again. But it also was really fucking long. It was like 27 hours or something to complete the campaign. Mm. Because I went through all that and it was like a long, dark period of gameplay. And then I never heard anybody else ever talk about it. Like people talk about Dawn of War 2 multiplayer and, just general impressions on like the first few missions. Like in my head, that experience of competing Dawn of War 2 was this long campaign thing that I went on just on my own and no one else ever did it. I'm glad to hear someone else did. Cause you didn't, like, I wouldn't advise anyone to do it. If someone was saying like, oh, should I play Dawn of War 2? I'd say, yeah, just play it for like 5-10 missions, and then you've got the idea, and you can more or less move on.
Well, the good news is it's free with the latest current issue of PC Gamer.
Ah.
If you pick it up, you get a code, and you can play it. It's a really interesting game, Dawn of War 2. Really, really interesting. Because it kind of, a lot of people at Reddick definitely play Dota and other games like that. And you can see them trying to create a focused strategy game about a small number of Dota heroes that you're constantly micromanaging, and that seems to be essentially what they were trying to do with Dawn of War 2. And I don't think it's quite a good fit for the fantasy, because people who are fans of Warhammer 40,000 love big armies and big lasers. And, you know, there's a sense of scale to it that's kind of integral to the whole identity of the franchise. But at the same time, it's a really fascinating game. And I fucking loved Retribution. Had loads of fun with it, especially with the Last Stand mode.
Yeah, Retribution is awesome.
And with all the kind of mini campaigns. And you got to play with not the Witch Hunter, Inquisitor. She was awesome.
Mm.
So is there anything else you want to know about Dawn of War 3?
You only saw Space Marines, right? So you don't know what kind of the elite units would be for the other factions.
No, that's still to be
revealed. Because the trailer shows, it makes quite a big deal of the Howling Banshees for the Eldar.
Mm.
And I'm kind of wondering if all the Aspect Warriors would have like their own elite unit.
No, Howling Banshees would definitely seem to be part of the line.
Ah, okay.
Because there were loads of them. The Space Marines killed loads of them. There's really interesting stuff with cover they've changed. So like assault units like Howling Banshees who are close combat, they exist, like their primary role is to break people in cover. Mm. So you drop them into heavy cover, which are basically like bunkers now, rather than just terrain that you kind of pop people in. And if you own the bunker, you're basically, it seems, invincible to ranged fire. So the only way the hard counter is some screaming space elves with swords that go in there and just, you know, nope. just break that.
I remember in Retribution, if you played as Chaos, one of their units was the Plague Marine.
Oh yeah, and the electric guitar guys.
He had the Plague Marine.
No,
Nurgle,
the Marines.
Disease.
Yeah.
And his main gun was like just sprayed disease. And of the many ways you could upgrade it so that like you could just fire it into a bunker full of Space Marines, and not only would the Space Marines like flop out of the windows dead, they would then get up and become zombies that just joined your side.
Amazing.
And so you could just like manufacture an army on the field.
Did you guys talk about the orbital space laser?
No.
Tell us more.
Good orbital space laser. Each faction has their own super ability. And the Space Marines is the orbital laser. The fictional idea is that there's a huge battleship in orbit called the Dauntless that's always poised to strike. And when you get enough resources or something, you can tell it to target an area. So an enormous space laser hits the ground when you activate the ability, and then you can move it around by right clicking like it's a unit and kind of.
That exact mechanic is in StarCraft Legacy of the Void.
Interesting.
Down to you having a ship in orbit. That you get in Legacy of the Void, it has its the Spear of a Dune, as it's called, has its own abilities that you can then choose before the mission with their own associated energy cost. But one of them, I think two of them are variants on, but what if we just shot the ground from space?
really
and you
effective.
Can guide it around with your mouse and stuff as well.
Yeah, that's how this works as well. In StarCraft 2, Legacy of the Void, did the beam get fatter the more things it ate?
No.
Because that's new for Dawn of War 3.
How does that work?
So
I think that's physics.
Laser is hungry.
Yeah, the laser, as it eats dudes, and you see them float up, and then they're sucked off the ground by the force of the laser, and then they turn bright, white hot, and then dissolve into ash, which it looks fucking awesome.
That's the best kind of... Was it us? Did we talk about this? That the best kind of orbital laser is that makes rubble float slightly?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, the Akira laser as opposed to the...
definitely.
Was it Akira that pioneered the old strike the ground, lifty up, then evaporate laser?
Might be an old manga trope, that one.
Yeah.
But Akira...
Isn't that in Dawn of War 1 in some form? Isn't that some
special ability? I spoke to...
I'm sure I remember things lifting
I spoke to them... So I went to Relic a few years back for a copy of Heroes 2 stuff, and I was talking to their designers, and a lot of them had worked on Dawn of War 1, and I was talking to the guy who invented the orbital laser, and he was like, "Oh yeah, Akira, yeah." They've definitely, like, as reference, watched kind of anime stuff, and they've taken it to a new extreme with the Space Marine orbital space laser, which as it eats things, it gets fatter and also slower, which implies it gets heavier in some way, which is really strange.
I'm full.
And the idea of it, apart from just it kind of looking cool and feeling really powerful, was that it kind of creates a kind of fun, moment where the enemy army is trying to get out the fuck out of the way as it's eating your dudes. And then as it slows down, it gets more powerful. It then lets them get out of the way more easily.
They could like feed it some shitty units so that it slows down and the rest of the way.
Yeah, just that would be such
make
an amazing.
Make the laser fatter. That's your job
amazing,
today.
That would be such an orc army thing to do. Like, yeah. Throw loads of snotlings into it and then just be like, oh, keep the hard boys safe. Yeah.
They'd have to understand the physical concept of like lasers eating things that makes them fatter and slower.
I think it's just a given in the Warhammer 40k universe, probably. Anyway, it looks absolutely fantastic. It's really, I love the kind of art style they've gone with as well, which is really super colourful. And bright, and the laser fire is really intense, and when armies clash, it just looks really exciting. And the armies are as big as Dawn of War 1 are probably going to be bigger in future missions. So I think it's going to be fucking awesome.
Awesome.
I'm really excited.
I was actually, I've downloaded Legacy of Void recently. I haven't played it yet, but I'm really keen to. Yeah. Mm. The reason I did was because I was watching some StarCraft 2 competitive stuff. I saw like the last GSL final, and then last GSL final was a PVT, so no Zerg in it, and I'm a Zerg fan, and so I kind of went looking for just, is anyone playing Zerg? Just show me some Zerg games. And luckily DreamHack can sort you out. Some great Zerg play in the semifinals, onwards, in DreamHack. And it's really cool, like the units they've added, I always find every time Blizzard change StarCraft, whatever they've done to Terran seems grossly unfair in the Terran's favor to me, because I'm always rooting for the other guy because I find Terran kind of boring, and particularly Zerg. Like Zerg versus Terran, when the Terran's playing well, it looks like the Zerg just has no chance, could never ever do anything, because the Terran's ability is just fucking amazing and can just counter everything, and it just looks like the Terran's bullying the Zerg. And then of course when you get a good enough Zerg, it looks like they can't be stopped. But watching the GSL final, like the Liberators they've added is, like, as far as I can tell, is a unit, a flying unit that in one mode can fight air, and then another mode can fight ground. So it's like a Viking that turns into a Banshee, which just seems like the best unit in the universe. And sure enough, people use them loads. Mm. I think it's not as overpowered as that sounds, because it takes a long time to change modes, and they can't move when they're attacking ground.
They're in ground attack mode. Yeah, it's like a flying siege tank.
Yeah,
would be another way of putting it.
That sounds fucking awesome too, though.
Yeah,
yeah. And then, so I'm always kind of expecting to be thinking, ah, Terran's OP, fuck this bullshit. But then actually, the Protoss stuff is really cool. The Adept is like a sort of Zealot-type unit, but has like a ranged attack, and then its ability is like a really cool spell idea that I don't think I've seen before, where I think it's called Fade. Am I getting that right?
Phase.
And a ghost form of them comes out of them. Usually you're controlling like a group of like eight or so. And so ghost versions of all of them come out, and you can control that separately, and you can kind of like scout with it or whatever. And then, they're a bit faster than the normal unit, and they can't be hurt or anything. And then at the end of the spell's duration, which is like a few seconds, you can decide whether to teleport your adepts to the position of the ghosts or just cancel it and just leave it there. And so that's quite like a simple idea, but then in practice, it just leads to all these crazy situations where, like, you can run away from a fight whilst also staying in the fight to finish it. And you can run away from a fight before you need to without even knowing whether you will need to or not. And then if it turns out you don't need to, you just don't teleport to the ghosts. And if you do need to, then you teleport to the ghosts.
They
also phase through things. So you can use them to get around bunker and stuff and into mineral, into worker queues and things like that.
StarCraft 2 seem now just about giving pro scene just extraordinary tools by which to do skill plays.
Yeah, so the theme of Legacy of the Void from a competitive point of view was adding new micro, raising the skill cap, because they sped it up a lot. Like, if you played any multiplayer StarCraft prior to Legacy of the Void, you have to relearn everything, because now you start with like 10 workers already at your mineral line. And already on your way. So basically, like, because typical build orders wouldn't really start until you had 10 workers.
Yeah.
So they just start the game there now.
Yeah, that's good.
And then it progresses much more quickly. Like, I'm Protoss main, and they added another thing called like a disruptor, which is like a little ball that triggers like an energy form where, again, it moves faster and it can phase through things. Hmm. But then you've got a limited time before it returns to reality. And then when it returns to reality, it like telefrags anything it's on top of. So it does, which is amazing against Zerg, but requires micro skill to even do anything. Hmm. Like, by itself, it doesn't even have an attack. It's just a ball that you have.
Okay. So I've seen those, and I thought they were firing something out, like a projectile.
They project themselves, basically. Oh, wow. They turn into a form. I do recommend it. The campaign's really good. Like, Blizzard are, it feels like, I reviewed it last year, but it feels like there's this one studio, Relic, I guess, being the exception, but Blizzard have just been sat there getting really, really good at making RTS campaigns in an industry where no one else was basically making traditional single player RTS campaigns. So, I mean, it is full of the most, it's very long, and it is full of the most, baffling space nonsense. I actually really enjoyed it because I liked to see what extreme of space nonsense they would go to next. Like, characters will meet each other in a corridor to have a meaningful conversation about just some syllables that you've never.
My rule with StarCraft fiction has been like, as soon as anyone uses the word "for" to mean "because," I skip the cutscene. "For I will do this." All right, I'm done.
Because it's the Protoss one.
Let's give it like, a lot of that.
you have to be in for like, yeah, sort of off-brand Shakespeare in play in space. But it's really fun. But the set pieces, the missions are beautiful. And I think I mentioned it on a podcast relatively recently, actually, as an example of a perfect difficulty curve where the stakes get higher and you feel like you're being a giant badass and you get cool units and loads of them. And it does the amazing StarCraft thing of having a totally different tech tree for the single player in the campaign, which they started to diverge in Wings of Liberty and experiment with it. And now they're just full on. The way it works is the Protoss, there are like lots of different tribes of Protoss basically from different planets. So there's like not like it's a bit like Warhammer or anything, but there are the, Tal'Darim Protoss, which are like Dark Eldar. There are the Dark Templars, which are like, what are the Eldar that aren't like really good?
Are they the
Warp Spiders and,
They've got Reapers who are kind of dark skulls. They've got skulls. Everyone has skulls.
They're talking about like Craft Worlds.
Yeah, like
Ulthway.
Ulthway. That's what I'm trying to think of.
That's the sinister one.
The sinister, but not dark.
Yes.
Eldar. Yeah. And then you have the golden armored kind of proper high elf kind of. But each of those factions is represented in game. Is each of those factions has their own version of every single Eldar, every single Protoss unit, and sometimes they are variants, and sometimes they are totally different units that fulfill the same purpose. And so what they've done is they've redesigned the tech tree, redefined the tech tree. Rather than like, you know, Robotics Bay creates Colossus and Immortal, it's like Robotics Bay creates, you know, heavy mechanical and gigantic mechanical, and those things mean different things. And then, because the story is about uniting all these tribes, you pick which of each tribe's version of a unit you want, but you only have that one. So like, I think it's the Tal'Darim warp ray is completely fucking crazy, because void ray is the one I'm getting the streams crossed now. Void, not warp. It's void in StarCraft and it's warp in Warhammer. Like has a thing where the beam, like, cause the void ray is the one that like fires a laser, and then the laser gets fatter the longer it lasts at somebody.
We've unlocked the tree.
Yeah. The laser gets fatter and fatter and fatter as it sits there and does its laser. Whereas this one starts, and then after a certain amount of time, the laser will then chain to a different unit and then a different unit. And so it sort of branches out like a spider web inside the thing. It looks really fucking cool.
That's nice.
That game's got X. If you like lasers.
Oh, I fucking love lasers.
Then, and you can't wait for Dawn of War 3, try StarCraft Legacy of the Void.
The Zerg unit they added two, I think, to competitive, but the one that's kind of really changing the way professional games are played is, the Ravager, which can fire, I think, a corrosive bile, which is basically like an aimed attack where you decide where on the ground you want it to hit, and then it hits like 2 seconds later. And so it's really, ship hitting like a very mobile target, but it's much more like area denial, which is a thing that, Ghosts do with nukes for the Terrans, but Zerg has never really had anything like that, and it's really cool to see like just the Zerg being able to like define where the battle goes and just like delay an attacking force, or just say, no, you can't come down this ramp, or you're gonna have to go over there,
or really fuck up some siege tanks.
Yeah,
it also hits air units and has friendly fire.
Yeah, I've seen it kill some Zerg, which is fun.
Good game. Top gam. What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing so I'll talk about non-VR thing first, because you're going to talk about VR at some point. And I've been playing Offworld Trading Company, which is the RTS designed by Soren Johnson, designer of Civ 4. Four.
Yeah, it's cool.
And John Schaefer is Civ 5. Who has since gone indie and made an RTS set on Mars with no combat. And it's just about, economics. And there are like 8 different resources, or maybe 10. And you are like competing companies on Mars. Earth has been fucked up, and you basically, for every resource, there's either a way to mine it from resource nodes on the map, or it's something you refine from the other resources, and there you can build a factory to do that. And so each resource has its own building type pretty much. And you found an HQ, and then first thing you do in it is, once the game actually starts, there's no fog of war. You can see everything everyone's doing all the time. And that is quite important, because you can see what resources they're investing in by what buildings they've built. But before it starts, you, get to see, last time we talked about this, it was in early access, I think. And I don't think it had a campaign, and I don't know if the bots were kind of up to scratch. But I didn't play it until it came out, partly because, mostly because I don't really play much early access stuff. I prefer to like wait till things are ready. But also I don't want to play multiplayer at all. I just want to play single player. And, I heard that it actually has like not only, you know, a bunch of tutorials and skirmish mode against the AI, but also like a whole campaign that's designed to be replayable that you can play as different factions. And so I was eager to try that out. And so I don't know quite how this works in multiplayer, but when the match starts, only a tiny area of the map is revealed, and you scan to reveal more of it. So you click where you want to scan, and it's a lot like a StarCraft scan. But the main thing it reveals is resources, and you can kind of see the area you scanned, it will tell you exactly what resources are there. And then surrounding it, there might be like little beacons just saying there's a resource here, but you don't know what it is yet. And so you scan there. But every time the scan finishes, it pauses the game. And so all the scanning process basically takes less than a couple of seconds. But in real time, you can take as long as you like over it. And the twist is that the AI are, anyone can found a base at any time during this. So if you scan and you find, okay, there's some iron here and there's some aluminum. I'm going to use the American version because I've been reading it that way. And there's some water, but there's no, I don't know of any silicon or carbon. And those are like, you know, resources that you need later on, not so much right away. And, so either I carry on scanning or I decide this is good enough and I put my base here and I'm going to mine those things and then we'll find out later where silicon and carbon are and I'll have to make maybe, if you can put a mine on anything anywhere on the map as long as no one else has claimed it first. But the further away it is, the more power it consumes if you're robots or fuel it consumes if you're humans, because there are the different factions also have different, like, resource dependencies. And so, it's this kind of like gambling game where like you find a good spot and you're thinking, there's a decent chance this is the best spot on the map. And if I keep scanning, every time you scan, there seems to be a chance that the AI will found their thing. Or I think maybe the AI wait for certain resources. And in particular, if you find like a geothermal vent, which is a really good place to put power, it tends to be that the AI will found something near that. And that game it's almost like reverse chicken or something. It's like you want egg. More information. A game of egg. You want more information, but also you really don't want someone to take that good spot that you've already found and you know it's good. And if you scan more and they take it, like the sense of kind of injustice is extraordinary. It's like, no, but I knew that was a good spot. I was going to take that spot. I knew it was good. Isn't there some way I can like bagsy it? If you can actually get in a situation where, like, often you only have two opponents in the campaign, and if both of those opponents found their bases before you do, then you might as well just scan the entire map because no one else is. It doesn't take any real time. They can claim resources, but they, you know, it's a question of split seconds of actual game time. So you can just scan the entire map and then find the absolutely ideal place, but more often than not, you find the ideal place is one of the ones that's already been taken. You can't found your base too near to those. And even if you find your base a little bit further away, you can't claim any of the resources that are very close to any base.
Mm.
So I will just spend like, if this was the whole game, I'd be quite happy. I can spend like 25 minutes on this just figuring out where like I think once or twice I've just scanned early and just thought, this place is fucking fine. I'll just settle here. If there's a better place, then fine. But, I'm pretty sure like this has nearly everything I need and everything else I don't need. I can long distance mine it. I don't mind. And that's every time I've done that, that's been the right call. And then other times, I've just had like a really infuriating thing where that base has loads and loads of iron and it has also has silicon nearby. And those are really important things, but it doesn't have any water and it doesn't have any carbon as far as I know. And then you scan, you find out, oh shit, there is carbon there and there's water like quite nearby. And there's no other place on the map that's anything like that combination of resources. And the objective of the game is to buy out your opponents. And it has a stock system that's quite involved where you can, everyone's company is kind of divided into 10 stocks. They also use the word shares, but that's confusing because they're basically equivalent, but with a different order of magnitude. And if you have half of your shares, then it kind of protects you against buyouts because it will, anyone can buy any one of your 10 shares in general, but your last five, if you own all of those, then they become like a block that no one can buy out except if they can do it all at once. And that will require like $500,000 or $1 million.
No one gets the majority of your company unless they can buy your entire company.
Yeah, you're protecting yourself against someone getting the majority. And then it has just sort of a gamey mechanic that also there's like, once you've done that, people have to buy it all at once and they have to pay double for it. And if anyone else owns some of your stock, like if enemy A owns some of your stock and enemy B wants to buy you, it costs them 20% more as well. And so it's this weird thing of like you build up and up and up to the point where you realize, and to the point where you know you can just buy someone out. Like I don't ever really buy a little bit of someone's company, because that just tells them you're coming for them, right?
Right.
And they're only AI, so I don't know how well they respond to that exactly, but I see other people doing it, and I'm playing the campaign at the moment. So that part works really well. I played a couple of skirmish games. The tutorials are really good. The tutorials have a load of, like, story would be the wrong word for it, but loads of personality. They're very well guided. Mm. They give you, in explaining the game, they also explain who the factions are and what their personalities are. So the first tutorial is, like, run by the robots, and you work for the robots, and they kind of mock you for being human. And every dialogue box that comes up that tells you something, instead of just having an okay button, the okay button is replaced by your response to it. So, like, that seems unfair, or why are we doing this? And then the next box will respond to that. And it's not like you don't have dialogue choices or anything, but it gives it so much character, and that stuff is really well written. It's really funny. So doing tutorials is really fun. Then I played a couple of skirmish games, and then I played the campaign. And weirdly, the campaign is very different. You can't buy out your enemies in the campaign. It's 7 matches, and between each match you get to buy some persistent upgrades, so you can improve the performance of all of your steel mills, or you can buy sort of the right to have a free black market trick every game, which are things that you can use to sabotage your opponents or sort of steal things. But within each match, you are... it's this... It feels like a system that's much more complex than it explains, because on every map, like, there's a habitat, which is where people actually live, and you're just a company, and you're just trying to make money and to mine resources and stuff, and no one really lives in your base. All the people live in the colony, and the colony is neutral, like, you can't interact with it really. And then in the campaign, every mission is, instead of being about buying out your opponents, you just have to buy as much stuff for the colony as you can. So it's like a competitive generosity game where, like, everyone's competing to be the most generous person to the colony. And the colony needs, it's got its own base building logic where it wants habitats and workplaces. And there'll be 3 different kinds of workplaces. And it wants to have 1 habitat per workplace because, like, you know, it's like 1 unit of population can either live or work in those respectively. But, and then whoever buys the most units for it wins the game, but each time you buy it, the price of them all goes up, and each one requires different resources. So to buy a habitat costs 100 aluminum and $8,000, and then when you buy the first one, it'll go up to $9,000, and when you buy the second one, it'll go up to $10,000. And it has its own logic for, like, okay, we've got 10 habitats and 9 workplaces, so it will tell you don't need any more habitats. The colony doesn't need any more habitats. But if you've got loads of aluminum, and you don't have any glass or circuitry that you need to buy the offices, then it's way, way cheaper for you to buy the habitat. And you still can, even though they don't need it. And the habitat bar goes up. And there's another bar below it. There's a workplace bar. And there's a kind of general bar that doesn't go up until they both go up. But I don't know why you should care about that bar. Because you still get, like, there's a tally of who's bought the most modules for the colony. And yours still goes up if you buy habitats. And they've got, like, for most part, it doesn't really matter, because, like, one of them costs steel and one of them costs aluminum, and both of those are quite common resources, and so you can just generate both and you buy one of each or whatever. But in my last game of that, there was no steel type to buy. You could only buy the really, really expensive ones or the habitats. And so I just bought loads and loads of habitats, and I couldn't tell, like, I'm fucking up the colony, definitely. Their colony is shit now.
Desolate city of apartment blocks.
Well, they got loads of, I think the people won't move in unless there's offices. I think I was supposed to care about how good the habitat was, because at the end of the match, like, if you bought 10 modules for the habitat or for the colony, and your enemies bought 5 each, you will get 50% of the revenue from that colony. And maybe the amount of revenue it makes in total is dependent on how many people they have working there. That would kind of make sense. But that's so kind of, like I say, it's only 7 matches. So the long-term revenue for these things, like, particularly on the second to last mission, who the fuck cares what the long-term revenue is? It's only going to affect, it won't even affect this cycle. Like, I'll never see any cash from that because the campaign's going to end.
I was going to ask if the campaign was basically teaching you how to be efficient at mine resources quickly, but it doesn't sound like that if it's got this quite...
No, they actually force you to play a skirmish game before you're allowed to play the campaign. Hmm. So it's not like a tutorial thing. They kind of... It's its own thing, and it feels like something that maybe its ambitions are bigger than it can explain to you, or maybe bigger than it actually accomplished. And the thing I wanted to say about it was, like, I can't really say why, but buying... Like, competitive generosity is nothing like as satisfying as buying out opponents. Buying out opponents, like... It's not a combat game.
That's the problem with literally the entire planet.
Well, that, yeah, so like corporate, cutthroat, hostile takeovers are satisfying for all the same reasons that combat satisfying games. Yeah. Like it works for all the same reasons that violence works. And it's not that you really want to do it in real life. It's just kind of vindictively pleasing to just say, all your shit belongs to me now. Cause I got
I think that this is what really impressed, what I loved about, Off-World Training Company when I played it in early access. It was the buyout moment. And you're right. It is basically an act of violence in video game terms, but it's an incredibly public one. Everyone can see who is buying what. And it's not like you've just headshotted someone really well and then everyone gets shown a video of that. Like imagine if that, how cool you'd, how good you would feel if that was the case. It's just that your influence is just so visibly being exerted over another person in a way that's actually kind of humiliating for them and incredibly satisfying to you. It's actually a very, very powerful mechanic. I think it's brilliant. Works so, really well.
I'm actually, the way the campaign works is you do six missions of the competitive generosity thing, which is weird. And then on the seventh, it becomes, like, for a while, it's eliminating players. So there's like sort of 10 people involved in the campaign and you eliminate one per mission. And then you end up with four factions. And the last match, you can buy people out. So I'm
like, it's just like the Godfather. This is the bit where, you know, it's the montage where everyone gets bought out.
So just before I came here, I was playing my last mission and I can eliminate people. And, there's been this one, like, thorn in my side the whole way called Genji 6, who's robot, and I'm robot as well. And he's always been the best player other than me in each game I've played. And so in the elimination thing, he's has the highest stock price. It's the hardest one to buy out. It costs 750,000 to buy him out. And then the other two, there's one who's really weak and there's another one who's kind of somewhere between the two. And so Genji is trying to buy out the weak one. He's buying share by share, stock by stock. He bought like three stocks in his company. And I was investing in food and food price was huge and no one else was really investing in food for some reason. Possibly because I had the AI on quite a low level. And food had gone up to like the most anything can cost is $1,000 per unit and food is on like 750 and the next most expensive thing was like 300 and I had invested massively in food. I had like 10 food farms, which is ridiculous. And I produced like over 1,000 food and I was just watching it tick up and I long passed the point where I could buy the weakest person. And I just thought there's three opponents. I don't want to buy the weakest one and then be stuck with the two strongest ones. Yeah. Who haven't just spent all their money and I have. And so I just kind of waited and I waited and I waited. I didn't sell any of my food. It just price just ticked up and up and up. And at some point it's going to crash, but it won't crash too suddenly. And I'm just getting more and more and more food and Genji is buying more and more of the weak one. And if he buys out the weak one, I think that's bad for me. I don't really know, but he's got like four of their 10 shares. And then I've ticked past the point where I decided I'm just going to buy the strong one. I'm going to buy the best player in the game other than me, which costs, you know, all of my money. I'm going to sell all of my 1,900 food at the best price food has ever been all at once and then buy him out. And it works so well that, cause A, I limited my best competition. And then also because he owned four shares of the weaker one, the weaker one became dirt cheap to buy out. And I could actually afford to do it without even saving up. I could just sell some more like, glass and silicon and some other like miscellaneous resources that weren't food and get enough money to just buy out the other one as well. So that's where I am just before I left. I bought out two of my opponents and the third one, who was kind of only mediocre, is still left. And I know I can take him. I can definitely buy him out.
It definitely has that. I remember playing it. I really like to play it again, actually, because I haven't touched it since I very first went into early access. And it was very, very early and quite unintuitive because I had none of those assistance features. But there's definitely the feeling of snowballing into victory in that way is actually remarkably similar to other kinds of RTS. It's just expressed in such a different way, but it is actually strange how similar it feels. Where the moment you realize your army is big enough to just roll the other guy.
Because it's very, like, you have to really think about prices and price fluctuations. Because when something that you have a lot of is selling for a lot, you want to sell it all. But if it's still going up, why sell it now? Why not just wait? And then the objective look things are always, you know, always worried about people buying you out. You're always worried. You want to spend a bit of money to secure your own stock. So you get to that 50-50 thing where, you're kind of protected. So that's motivating to spend like, you know, 40,000 of your money and you need like 500,000 to buy out another player. But you can just kind of bide your time and bide your time. And so like most of the game, I'm just sitting there just watching this number go up and up and up. And it's really, it's like exciting and tense, because it's this, you know, number in its thousands multiplied by this number in its hundreds. And every time you can hover over the button to sell everything of one stock is like you hold Alt and then click the minus sign. And if you hold Alt and hover them over the minus sign, it tells you how much money you'd make now. And so if you can just leave that the cursor in that position and keep holding down Alt, and you can see the total money you get from it, basically the total value of your stock ticking up. And in the competitive generosity games, each time someone buys something, the price goes up by about 1,000 or 2,000. And so you want to buy things early. You want to be the guy who buys the first 10 of them, and then everyone else has to buy them at the really expensive prices. But at the same time, if you've got like a huge amount of food and it's ticking up at like a decent rate, then the total amount your stock is increasing in value can be like $2,000 a second. And so if it's only, as long as they're not buying modules at more than one per second, then it's better to just let them buy the cheap ones, even though you're dooming yourself to buy all the expensive ones, because your value is going up by so much compared to theirs.
Huh. Sounds rad. I want to get back into it. I play some multiplayer games. It sounds like in multiplayer it could be really, really interesting.
Yeah. I don't want to play multiplayer because I'm too scared. But I think I'm going to play... There's like a daily challenge mode, which sounds really interesting. And I think after this I'm just going to play skirmish modes. I was going to... The idea of playing the campaign as different factions was really appealing, because there's four basic factions, and then you actually unlock new factions by playing the campaign. I don't think they're properly new factions. I think they're kind of like... And these guys are also the robots, but they have this perk or something like that. Because the campaign has loads of perks that kind of stack on top of your normal things. But I just don't really like that module buying game anything like as much as I like the stock game. So I think I'm probably going to stick to skirmishes after this.
What have you been playing, Tom S?
I've played 3 hours of The Witcher 3's final expansion. She's called Blood and Wine.
What's the last one called? Hearts of Stone?
Hearts of Stone, Blood and Wine. They sound like album titles.
Yeah.
Kind of 80s band. Blood and Wine is set in the south of France, basically.
Nice.
It's a place called Toussaint, and it's...
Isn't that in America?
Yeah. And it's very funny and very colourful, and not everybody who lives there exists in a state of total misery, which makes it very different from most of the other Witcher 3 kind of colonies that you visit through the course of the campaign. I really like it, what I've played of it. I think it's brilliant. In fact, I might kind of prefer it to a lot of the main game, which is relentlessly grim for the first 10 hours, where you have to kind of fight your way out of this swamp land called Velen, where everyone is having a shit life and there's nothing you can do about it. But you're invited by the kind of Duchess to come to this land, and you're invited by a couple of her kind of honor guard who arrive in Velen in bright gold armor and are immediately attacked by bandits, because everyone in Velen is being attacked by bandits all the time, because it's more bandits than like the main kind of the main economic force in the area is banditry. I don't know how it exists as a kind of functioning society, but anyway, they don't have a good time of it, because the guys in gold armor are wearing gold armor for a reason, because they're quite good, and a lot of people have tried to take it off them, and you can choose to help them or not. But so they invite you to Toussaint, and you ride in on your horse, and you're confronted by this absolutely beautiful kind of Mediterranean landscape with fairy tale castles on the horizon, and like you look around and you can see like other little kind of villages and all of that you can go to. And it's an area that's about a third the size of the Witcher 3 main game, again, as an expansion, with its own kind of, about 90 quests, side quests included, about 30 hours of play, and, a new kind of systems for leveling Geralt up and kind of mutating him. It's making me even more powerful, particularly his spells. So his spells, once you've got the right mutations, can cause critical hits. And depending on the spell you use, the crit does different stuff. So if you use the kind of Igni spell, it just blows them up. And the Ard spell, which is kind of a telekinetic push, force push, can freeze them, which kills them instantly, as it should, unlike in other fantasy games. If you freeze someone to a block of ice, they are dead. as far as I'm concerned. It's not like Dragon Age Inquisition, where you could just freeze people and they kind of freeze for a bit, and then they just kind of thaw out and they're completely fine again. I was like, that's so stupid. But it's really good. It's really funny because, it's funny to see Geralt, who's this incredibly stern, villain. You know, he does have a kind of good sense of humor himself. He's got a very dry sense of humor, but seeing him kind of, come into contact with this society that's based around chivalry and grand fairs, where everyone's dressed in kind of colorful, armor and they joust and they race. And they're easily offended. And putting a guy like Geralt into that situation is really, really good fun. And they milk it for all it's worth. And it's full of quite good comedy characters. Like, there's a knight who's trying to woo one of the ladies at court, by fighting big things, but he's shit at it. It's really bad. And, it's all stuff you've kind of seen before in other fantasy fiction, but it's really well done. And I think their writers are actually, they've got really good now at kind of creating a balance between high adventure and moments of darkness and brutality and gore that obviously underlies everything in the world of The Witcher. There's always someone being butchered somewhere, and there's always a horrible crime scene for Geralt to find and investigate. Only this time it's hidden behind a veneer that's much more attractive, and the contrast between those two things is more interesting as a result. But you expect to find the first thing you see when you get into Velen is just like a load of people hanging off a tree, and you know, and there's where do you go from there, really? Like everything you see is going to be like at the same tone. You see people like chunked up bodies in the river. It's like, okay, yeah, that's Velen. Whereas when you see it in the context of this beautiful place full of, you know, beautiful castles and people who basically live a much better life than they do elsewhere in the world, as soon as this violence happens, it somehow becomes more meaningful and more exciting, more interesting to investigate. And the bad guy's really interesting as well.
It's almost like the blood side of it contrasts with the wine side of it.
Oh my God.
But those things are sort of intricately linked.
Especially when vampires are involved and
or Jesus Christ.
Elements. Or Jesus Christ. Maybe he's the villain.
Also had a strong blood wine connection.
Yeah. Mm. I think it's going to be fantastic. It's the last thing they're doing before I guess they move on to their cyberpunk game, which will be exciting. But yeah, I just wanted to say that was good.
I need to play The Witcher.
That's the thing, isn't it? It feels as though it's a lot of game to play to get to the expansion. I'm not sure when you can access it in the campaign.
I was going to ask, does it sort of take place after the events of the main campaign, or is it just a thing you can go to separately?
The fact that it unlocks a lot of kind of, I don't know, the fact it unlocks a lot of high level combat technique-y things and has a lot of kind of end game progression stuff. For example, you get the deed to your own vineyard as part of this expansion.
High level combat technique.
Yeah.
You get a blood vineyard or a wine vineyard?
It's a wine one.
It's a choice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that'd be an amazing choice. You can upgrade it though. You can upgrade it to have more kind of armor slots. So you can show off your armor and hang up your swords.
Oh, I see. I was imagining the vineyard having armor like being
You can also choose what paintings to hang up and stuff like this. It's like you're supposed to create your own.
Can you improve the quality of the wine? How long does it take before you turn a profit in the wine? Because it doesn't have to age for quite a while.
Well, it seems that it's a shit vineyard. The guy who owned it before was bad at wine things. And Geralt, as a guy who basically spent his entire life killing bandits and occasionally a monster, is also clueless about brewing wine. But that does come up, actually. He does speculate about perhaps retiring and living his life as an old witcher, brewing shit wine in fake France.
Geralt Lambrini.
Yeah, going to a stag party near you. Great. It's brilliant. It's really good. What have you been playing, Chris?
So I haven't actually played a tremendous amount of you because I'm still playing Hitman, and I don't think I have any further Hitman hot takes.
Hey, Hitman is bullshit if you lose your connection or if they lose their connection.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, actually, that's true. Actually, after the podcast last week when I fancy playing it for a bit, I just couldn't because it just wouldn't connect at all. It turned out to be, I think, a DirectX issue, but still, that's bollocks.
I saw people being angry about that and I didn't, I thought, yeah, fair enough, but I knew there's an offline mode and I thought, how much can you really care? And then I tried the offline mode and it's fucking awful. Mm. Like you can't even look at what the challenges are. You're not even allowed to see what the challenges are. They refuse to give you a rating when you finish. They can't tell you whether you weren't spotted. They can't tell you if they're recording.
None of your existing saves are compatible. So yeah. If you were so halfway through a mission, yeah.
It's like pointless as well. I don't understand why they would need to put that all that server side.
But anyway, so in place of that, I have now, as you guys can see in this room, set up a Vive, and I'm playing with that.
Woo.
And I wanted to sort of give the alternate experience of that because, so this is a work vibe that I borrow. Setting up in an office is actually a giant nightmare, we've discovered. So sort of passing them around between the people who need them. But so my office, which we're in right now, has like tall bookcase in one corner and a tall wardrobe in the other corner, and it's otherwise big enough. And as a result, I think I had probably the most painless live experience. Like, I totally get that, and I've totally seen how much of a problem it can be. And I know, Tom, that you had a mare getting it to work properly.
No mirrors in this room, I noticed.
No mirrors in this room. things that could potentially disrupt it. Fixing everything, like, at first I thought I was maybe putting it all together too recklessly, but actually fixing everything in place. I think as long as you sort of, I think the key to it is if you have the ability to easily put a little box on a stand on above 7 feet in two different corners of the room, everything else is pretty easy. Like, I found it quite easy to get them to see each other, to calibrate and so on. And actually I thought the calibration, the setup process is actually really fun when you realize, like, cause I was kind of lucky, like it gets you to put the controllers and the helmet on the floor. And that's how it finds out where the floor is. Mm. And then you trace out the outskirts of the room with one of the pads and stuff. And there's a brilliant moment where this all seems to be happening in the installer, basically, for the Vive. And then it says, okay, we'll do the rest of this in virtual reality. Like, put your headset on and put your headphones on. And that's a really cool moment. Like, I had assumed that because, like, when I tried the Vive previously at the International last year, you know, someone was in a room designed for it and they passed me the pads and that was kind of cool, but whatever. But there's something about, it's such a small thing, but I think VR is made up of small things. There's something about going into, putting the helmet on, and suddenly you're in this white room that stretches out around you in, you know, the vast distance. And you look down at your feet and there are the controllers that also exist in the real world, and you lean down and pick them up, and the in-game model for the controllers is exactly the same.
Yeah.
As the real ones. You can actually get Steam Workshop skins for them if you want, but they're exactly the same. And that, I think, is the 3D positional tracking is so good that feels amazing. It's not, it breaks through that thing that VR traditionally has of, like, or that I've definitely found with the Rift, where it's like, my hands know what to do with an Xbox controller, therefore it's kind of okay that I can't see my hands or what I'm holding. And obviously you can't see your hands in the Rift, but because the thing you're holding in the game is one-to-one with the real thing, it's really fascinating how well that makes you feel like you can comfortably interact with the world.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, if you depress the trigger in real life, the trigger, you see the trigger move perfectly in line with that on the virtual version as well. Hmm. And those are the little things that make a difference.
They actually have like one tiny difference between the virtual one and the real one is the virtual one has a battery indicator on it. Because they can just display sort of like in lights as how much battery it has.
Of course, yeah.
Which they didn't put on the real one.
But it also has the other status lights that exist on the real one as well. Like, and so there's that seamlessness, which is super important. And also...
And when you touch the touchpad, it will show you where your thumb is on the touchpad as well.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so they can do that thing. So the tutorial, like, they have different buttons on the pad light up to show you this does that. Which I've seen something a real pad couldn't do, but it feels remarkably natural. They even have the thumb pad change into four different buttons. In a way that feels remarkably natural, even though, again, it's totally impossible. And so after that, and so I still got up and running fairly quickly, and Pip was out. So it was just me and in a room. And then I've been playing with the lab. I haven't, you know, got any other software for it. So I've just been doing the various lab demos. But the moment where it kind of loads you in, you're standing on a mountainside in Washington State, sort of area recognized, actually. I think I've been walking around there in the past couple of years. I was just stood there in my room with a massive grin on my face. Like, VR's cool, but this is the first time I've ever been like, oh man, this feels like a total treat for some reason.
Yeah. It was so different doing it in my house than it was when I'd done it at a demo and, you know, in an office. Like, something about, I mean, actually it was a later version of technology, so it might just be better, but, I had like a moment where it worked fine for me, and then I moved things around and then it stopped working and I couldn't get it to work, and it was because of my mirror. But like, having like tasted how good it was and then having it denied to me was like so frustrating. It was like, oh, this was incredible. Hmm. Like, in a way, when I came away from like having played it at Valve's offices, I was, like very interested in it. I thought it was very cool. I didn't have the same like emotional reaction that a lot of people had. Like, you know, some people just bowled over by it, like in tears and stuff. And then it was only when I tried it at home that I really kind of got it and really got excited about it.
And it was genuinely like, and then I, you know, I've been having loads of fun with it. Like even just the lab stuff, like it's, I was thinking that the lab would be a collection of mini games and it totally is, but, and it is certainly, there's a huge diversity of ideas in there, but it definitely feels like quite a polished Valve thing. Like it very much is set in the Portal universe, sort of. And it has like, there's little things that are almost certainly some sort of stroke of genius when it comes to interacting with the virtual thing, but are inherently silly. So in the Vive, in the lab, all the different games you can do are represented as like different parallel worlds. And there's a joke to that effect near the start. Including the hub lab where you return to.
I didn't even realize for a long time that like there's an announcer voice who keeps, I thought it was just like background noise. You keep saying like, something in Universe 7 has invented the concept of evil, and something in Universe, and then I realized, oh shit, Universe 7 is me. Cause like the time when she said, like, Universe 7 has invented the concept of evil was just after I'd used the remote control drone to just shoot some of the workers who are working on the conveyor belt. I was like, oh, that makes sense, actually.
There's so much stuff like that in it. And like, and so, but one of the things you do is you go over, you use the sort of teleport to a point movement system, which is remarkable how natural that feels, like teleporting the block of space you're standing in around the room, and so then you can explore with your actual body. You, in order to go to a world, you pick it up, basically. You pick up this orb, which is like a little portal orb thing, and then you move it to your face, or you put your face in it. And I very quickly, and I think Pip, well, so I very quickly started thinking of it like I was eating it, because you sort of lift it to your mouth. And so when I was teaching Pip to use it, I was like, I was showing her the planetarium one where you can sort of wander this massive scale model of the solar system. It looks incredible, and like pluck planets out of their orbit and throw them at things and stuff like that.
Amazing.
It seems amazing. And I was like, okay, and now reach out and take, grab the portal. Okay, now put it in your mouth. And then for some reason we both end up in a situation wherever you, and then when you want to go home, you press a button on the pad and the pad sort of sprouts the portal orb for the lab itself. And now it's this thing now where you just sort of like pick it up and then you kind of and then you teleport. It's great. I love the archery demo longbow. It's great. Yeah. I know you spoke about it last week, but like I, that's my like, I, there's some action games, like I felt this way about Devil Daggers, which I spoke about before, and very twitchy stuff. There's another cool arcade shooter in there, which is like playing Galaga, but your hand is the Galaga spaceship and you're weaving around in real time. Which is super cool. But Longbow's great because it has that sort of arcade score attack precision thing that's quite physical in real life, but it has that same effect on me that those games do, where it's sort of like getting into the zone and getting kind of like, I don't know if I've spoken about this on the pod before, but like taking a measure of how sharp I am that day by sort of doing this sort of like high intensity, quick arcade archery thing.
I was amazed at how fast I improved in it in my first go, and then also amazed at how totally I could lose that skill the next time I played.
Like, I've done the thing once or twice now where I've headshotted a guy and then hit all three balloons that come out of him, which feels fucking amazing. Yeah. Like, having just seen Captain America Civil War and always kind of wanting to have been Hawkeye if I had to be one of the special super people, there's a moment where you're like, yeah, this is the, I am the fucking best at this specific thing. Particularly because also I had to figure out my handedness as well. Come, I'm left-handed. That's another good thing, because everything's totally ambidextrous. It lets you pick up the bow with your other hand and not just from the other side. And
I love that. Also, like, so I guess, yeah, you sort of, you decide which hand to pick it up with in the longbow demo. I've also been playing Hollow Point, which is the archery, like a game just about archery for VR. And in that, the bow already starts in your hand, and I think it started in the wrong hand for me at first. And then I realized, oh, I can just change what hand I'm holding the controllers in. Like, it's just like, it's tied to that controller. It's not tied to my hand. So I just switched controllers. And Hollow Point is definitely gives you that same thrill. It's, but you're in a dojo and it's quite shonky. If it, like, it's not properly out yet. I think it's still in early access, but, it feels like a sort of lower fidelity version of Longbow, but what you're doing in it is just shooting these, like, apparently there are samurais who run at you later, but I never even encountered those yet. Shooting these cubes that just appear in the dojo. And I think they're actually randomized each time. Just a cube appears hovering in space. Sometimes a really big one, sometimes a semi-small one, and you've got to shoot it with an arrow, and it's the same controls as Longbow. And when you hit it, it fires a bullet at you. And the bullet doesn't go super fast, and if it gets towards, like, close to your head, then it goes into slow-mo. And all you gotta do is move out of the way. And so the first time I played it, I just, every time I shot one, because it always fires exactly where your head is at the time you shoot it, I would just always duck. And you can kind of do that, but it's not that much fun. And then pretty quickly I realized, like, you don't have to get your whole body out of the way. It's just your head, really. And as long as you just, even in quite a small space, you can just kind of lean out of the way. And then it quickly becomes, you can take it pretty much at your own pace. And so they only shoot at you when you shoot at them. And the sort of challenge is like, how quickly can you take them all out? And so it's just, it's archery plus that bit in the Matrix where he dodges the bullet by leaning backwards in slow-mo. And like, that's awesome in itself. Alternating between archery and then dodging bullets in slow motion is fucking amazing. And then once you start to get like, okay, I want to do well at this and I want to hit the next one right away and I'm ready for it. I don't mind that this other bullet is still coming towards me. It becomes doing archery while dodging, like in the Matrix. And that is fucking amazing. Mm-hmm. Like leaning back out of the way of one bullet to shoot something else that's behind you and up and to the left and also on the second floor. And it's a tiny target. And then you hit it and then that's going to fire another bullet at you and you know where it's coming. So you can look away from it and duck it without even looking at it and then shoot another one. And then you get like panicked because you've shot two of them and then another one's coming. If you leave them long enough without being shot, they'll fire of their own accord. And there's one you haven't seen directly above you at a moment where I just like shot two of them and dodged both their bullets. And then like, as I was dodging, I caught sight of the one above me and realized like, oh shit, it's gone bright red, which means it's just about to fire and it's too late for me to hit it. And I was just like, I was going to try and shoot it anyway and see if I can intercept it. I was too slow. It fired its bullet at me. I shot, my arrow hit the bullet and shattered the bullet. Yeah. And I was like, I survived. That's fucking amazing.
That's awesome. It's like, so I anticipated that VR would be embarrassing from an outside perspective because you are, you know, wearing a, like goggles and holding paddles and waving around like a dickhead. And that's all true. But the additional element of that I hadn't really thought about is how cool you think you look, which is an additional degree of danger. So I've had it, I definitely had it the longbow thing because I find that like I close one eye when I'm doing longbow so I can aim more easily, which is a good example of the fact that actually VR depth perception works because I'm doing the thing I would do in real life to aim at a distance better. But I've also found that I use the bow sideways quite a lot, like notch the arrow on top of the flat of the bow and then fire like that, especially if there's someone right below the battlement because I can then the bow itself isn't obscuring my view. So I'm firing sideways, which sounds pretty cool. And then you start to do the trick stuff, like trying to like notch one backwards behind your head, like, or like do the blind shot sideways and stuff like that. And then when you do something like that and you're alone in a room, but you're still like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other game that's got good for that is Slingshot, which I don't know if we talked about.
That's part of the lab, right?
Yeah.
I still haven't played that one.
Play that one. So, It's really super simple. You are in a, you're standing on this, basically this like ledge platform in a huge Aperture Science, warehouse. And it's this cavernous thing that goes on forever, basically with these massive teetering like Jenga towers of storage crates that also include explosive barrels and thicker crates and stuff like that. And each of these is teetering over a kind of floor that in places have pits in it with like these kind of like channels leading down to pits. And behind you is a conveyor belt and there's like turret parts and stuff going past and you'll sometimes see like Animal King turret bits and stuff like that. There's little portal references and parts of personality cubes. And there's a console on one side of you that just says like damage in dollars. And in front of you is this huge apparatus, which is like this massive high tech slingshot, hence the name. And your interaction is to grab the back of it and then pull it back and aim it in sort of 3D space, in order to fling balls at the towers in order to do damage, in order to, you know, Angry Bird style, in order to get money. And then as you get above certain money thresholds, then you get given a replenished stock of projectiles and it's only game over when you run out of projectiles. The thing that makes it brilliant is every single projectile is a different personality sphere and it's a completely new set. They actually look very different. They're more like Tron, like they're these black cubes with like Knight Rider style sound lines when they're speaking. And it's not any of the portal ones, like the space cube or the space sphere or anything like that. They're all new and they're very, very well written. I think a bunch of them are, voiced by dude from Rick and Morty, whose name completely escapes me because I've had an old fashioned and a half. Justin Roiland?
Yes.
Yes. And a bunch of them aren't, but, and like, you know, and so, and it's very much a big pile of portal jokes. And so part of the tension of it is when these balls come up, they'll say whatever their gag is, basically. They'll talk to you constantly until you fire them. And then it cuts seamlessly into them screaming when you let go. So it doesn't really matter what they're saying. Sometimes they'll scream something specific to them, but sometimes you're just, and sometimes they're happy and sometimes they're not. There's some really good example. I'll give some good examples without spoiling the whole lot, but like there's the villain sphere who, and this, I don't know, maybe they do listen to the things we talk about on this podcast, but which says the moment it comes out into the catapult goes, we're not so different. You were both trapped. You in this warehouse, me in my genius, and also this warehouse.
And in wealth.
Yeah. And then you let go and you can let go at any point in the monologue and you just say this, ah! I say,
if only you could have done that to Breen.
Yeah. The other amazing one is the detective sphere, which is a hard-bitten noir detective, who's like, there's a lot of damage being done in this warehouse. And I have to say, the lead suspect is you. And they, he screams, guilty! And they appear in a random order. But I think the detective sphere is always followed by the morning sphere, as in M-O-U-R, yeah. Who pops up and goes like, I'm very sorry. I have bad news. The detective sphere is dead. And it's just a catapult game. It's just a big 3D VR Angry Birds catapult game. Mm. But for some reason, that makes it brilliant.
It's got like Valve humor.
Yeah. There's one of the tutorial one is called the Tracer Sphere, who's like a kind of American army drill sergeant. But when he's in the catapult, you can actually see what, like a line showing where he'll go, which is to get your eye in, basically.
Right.
And he's the one who's really happy to be there. Like, you know, Tracer Sphere is here to help. And then when you basically run out of spheres without going below the threshold, these words float up in front of you that just say career over. And sometimes you'll get an extra Tracer Sphere, but like, Tracer Sphere is here to save your career. And you have one shot to get back into it. It's super cool. But yeah, there's also the Dota Secret Shop thing, which is amazing, which is exploring this giant fantasy environment, incredibly detailed, where you can go from being huge to being tiny to being, you know, to scuttling along a shelf and stuff. It's awesome. And that's just one thing. Like, I'm, you know, going to dabble in other stuff, but it's also not my vibe. So I don't want to get too attached.
I wanted to take it home, but, I always have like, do you guys feel unsteady when you're wearing it? Like it really fucks with my balance when I put it on for some reason.
That, yeah. I'm fine. I didn't get motion sick with the Rift really in any version either. So I think maybe I'm lucky.
Yeah, I don't get motion sick with the Vive, but I always feel unsteady on my feet as I'm about to fall over.
So, people won't mind me telling the story because she wrote about it for RPS. So I don't, like, afterwards I felt a bit weird. Hmm. Like, I used it for a while, like, as I say, Pip was out and I, like, set it up and I was so excited to do it work properly first time that I spent about an hour and a half in there. Which is probably way longer, like, I actually could imagine myself doing longer experiences in it. I don't know if that's true, but when I left, like, the next morning I had a faint headache, and for a while I just felt a bit strange, like, not sick or queasy or anything. It's hard to pinpoint exactly how I felt. But I'd done something weird to my brain. Like, not, you know, hard to pinpoint. And then late at night, you know, Pip got in and she played with it for a while and seemed to be having, you know, a perfectly good time and didn't feel sick or anything like that. And then afterwards, we were getting ready for bed and Pip turns to me and says, this is real, right? And it wasn't that she'd gone mad. It's just that you'd sort of gotten so used to walking within the bounds of the chaperone light grid and to think, but also for things like you can phase through furniture. You know what I mean? Like if you move yourself up to the edge of a piece of furniture and you walk into it, that's fine in VR. To the point where those little patterns of movement and perception, when you get out of it, I can see how that would briefly change the way you thought about real physical space. Mm. Like suddenly the ability to walk out of the 1.5 meter by 2 meter laser grid that you've created for yourself. It's like you just got to reintroduce yourself only slightly to the idea that that's possible. You don't have to teleport across the room.
It's weird because I would have predicted that like it would be hard to get your brain used to the idea of stopping when the thing comes up, or sort of, you know, obviously when you see it coming you can stop, but then like, don't jump. Don't throw yourself in one direction. Don't, when you see a threat coming, don't stagger back 6 paces because you'll hit something you can't see. And actually in practice, I've never had that trouble. I've very quickly internalized that thing. But yeah, it becomes like a really ingrained thing. So I can well imagine, I read Pip's article on RPS, like sort of taking it off and then still being worried about the chaperone bounds in real life.
Yeah. And anyway, so, and I think she was just feeling a little bit kind of wobbly or whatever. And then, while we were getting ready for bed, we were just talking and Pip just fell the fuck over sideways, just like standing 1 minute, falling over the next. And, that is actually not that common, I should stress. And it was just, it was very funny. I made sure she was okay, but it was also very funny. But it was like, yeah, just, I don't know. I think VR's, we'll probably, over the next course of the next couple of years, as the technology gets better and better, discover a whole bunch of weird things VR does to the human brain that would probably, that go beyond seasickness and nausea, which were problems with just basic technical limitations of the, like, it feels like the initial wave of problems were due to the screens not being good enough, the motion sensors not being good enough. Now we're encountering the problems that you get when they are good enough to convince your brain that two different things are real.
Yeah.
And that's when you start to get into the really wacky shit.
I should say, actually, that HoloPoint, as great as it is just cable problems the game. It is a game in which you have to rapidly turn around in a dojo. Things come at you from behind and from the sides, and it's, you know, the better you want to do, the quicker you have to do that. And it turns out you don't have an internal counter in your head as to how many times you've turned clockwise, for example. Like, if it told me on screen you've turned 3 times clockwise, maybe turn anti-clockwise now, then it would be okay. But I guess I just always instinctively turn left, or maybe I just have a bias towards one direction or the other, so that the first 3 games I played of it, it's like a sort of survival thing. It goes on and on. And every round I played was ended by me getting in such a tangle with the cable that I eventually just kicked it out of the PC, at which point your entire world goes black. Reality ends.
You're dead now.
And you're left just like sweating and panting in a room with it. So I'm like, what just happened? Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. The whole kit feels like as relatively easy a time I had getting it up and running. It does feel still a bit like a dev kit. Just because the amount of cables that you guys can see in this room at the moment, I have one cable going off the top of a bookcase down behind a chest of drawers to a plug. The cable for the other base station is running down a wardrobe to an extension cable, which runs under my desk. And then under my desk, I have another extension cable, then a kind of pile of USB hubs. Like, this room is covered in cables anyway because of the podcast setup, but now it literally, it's just everywhere. Like, there doesn't seem to be an elegant solution to the cable problem, for example, and so on.
I also found that the base stations like make a noise when they're on. They kind of make a whirring noise.
When they switch on, yeah, they basically settle, I found.
Yeah, well, I found mine just, there is some option. There are 2 different options menu for VR. Like once you're in it, you can access an options menu, but there are some hidden options that you can only access if you're not using VR at the time. So if you go to the options on your desktop, you get a totally different set of options. And one of those says that you can use Bluetooth to like calm them down when it's not on. But by default, like once you exit VR, it turns off the controllers, it turns off the headset, but the base stations just carry on going for me and they make a whirring noise all the time.
Yeah, that's why I've unplugged them actually.
So yeah, I have them on a separate extension cord and I just turn off that whole block so that they can shut up.
So that's another thing. Lasers.
Yeah, it feels like very much version 1 of a thing.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's super cool, but yeah, like I'm actually insofar as I'm kind of glad that I have had the chance to try it out before necessarily diving in on it because it is obviously still super early. But for that, despite that, it's all amazing how well it works.
While you have it, you should play Budget Cuts because that is it's free. It's just a free demo. So,
awesome.
Should we do questions?
Yeah, but
yeah, let's do it.
I kind of want to start with something that kind of goes beyond questions.
Beyond questions from
into questions from mad special projects we didn't know were happening, but are fucking awesome.
Yeah. We just read this in the break and have discovered a rabbit hole that we've gone down, discovered more and more depths to this thing. So I'll just read the email first from Kane. Dear Imesh, Famthut Yvonne, Thimshur, and Thimo, and CC Rinmol and Belbom, on the occasion of Pip officially joining the podcast, please accept Creighton Dwarf Bar, a depiction of the Creighton Crowbar in Dwarf Fortress. We'd hope to have this finished in time for the podcast's 0th pipiversary, but then I ran into quite literally all of the problems, so apologies for it being late. We're still cleaning up the save file and testing it to make sure it works on other computers than just mine, so it's just the screenshot galleries for the moment. We hope to send you the save sometime this week, so you can explore it for yourself if you like. Some additional notes. So before I go on, like, they've sent a bunch of screenshots, which we'll talk through in a minute. Some additional notes. The work was done mainly by me and Veer Serif. A few others, like Jammy and Menthol Penguin, looked it over while it was in progress and gave their opinions when we couldn't decide on the name or design. And Bean offered some ideas that made it into the final version. We did do a significant amount of hacking and modding to get everything in, but a surprising amount of it is legitimate. For example, we only added 9 words to the Dwarven language to make the titles. Crate, crowbar, bard, knob, penta, plural, second, wound, and graven. And most of those were only ever used once. Veer Serif, I guess it means, like, those are the ones they had to add to the language that weren't already there. Veer Serif, as a conlang enthusiast, translated quite a few things, including a small section from the design doc, using pre-existing Dwarven words. Her translations of your names are included in the map album. Also, while a lot of the design elements are obviously modded in, worm tendrils and staring eyeballs are actual things in Dwarf Fortress. So is the deformed messenger. And I was very happy when the game gave us Devils of Water for the Met Office episode. Crate and Crowbar was created by a barony in 127. We had to pick a dwarf to be elevated to the title of Baron. We chose Tom F, of course. We modded in the crowbar and custard. It is twice as valuable as sunshine. So, if you didn't understand any of that,
so we should back
we will
up
now
bit.
Explain.
Yeah, because, yeah, well, we read that and we're like, what the fuck? which is, so, a group of people from our Discord community have created in Dwarf Fortress, the Crate and Crowbar pub, hypothetically, the hypothetical pub suggested by the name of this podcast, which would be one thing, which would be one impressive, cool thing to have done. What they have subsequently done, however, is in the words of a character in the latest Game of Thrones, no spoilers, fucking mad. So those names that you heard at the start of the email actually are names translated into the actual Dwarf Fortress Dwarven language. So I am Imesh Amud Lam, sprinkled Thunderstone, because Chris is from Christos to anoint, and Thurston means Thor's stone or Thunderstone. So, Tom Francis is, Thimshur Locum, partnered spear. Paired spear, because Thomas means twin, and Francis comes from Frankish or Frank, which is a kind of javelin. But Tom Senior is Thimshur also, or Thim the Elder. Thimshur Okir, because of the senior Thomas, so that makes sense. And then you have Pip, who's Famfoot Evan Aurel Adil, Horse Lover Waterwall. which is Pip. From Philip, which comes from horse loving one in Greek, war from war meaning dam or weir. So water wall, but it makes me think of Wonderwall.
Yeah. I thought of that as well.
So I think whenever Pip enters the room now, I'm just going to be like, anyway, here's Wonderwall. So I think maybe when we got to this part of, we'll obviously link all of these image galleries with pictures of the place and the layout and so on. And to be honest, we don't have time in this podcast to go through everything that's in here because, for us, it felt, I think, like falling down a rabbit hole, but there's a lot of really good gags.
So,
there are 2 libraries. One is a public library called, Where are we? The Resonant Ludonarratives. And then there is a secret library called the Dissonant Ludonarratives. And we now have to drink.
Yeah. That's awesome. The Resonant Ludonarratives almost sounds like Resident Ludonarratives, which would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Oh, quick aside on that. Uncharted 4 has an achievement called Ludonarrative Dissonance.
That, didn't they? Yeah, it's for killing loads of people. Some way to solve that problem, Naughty Dog, is
well
to
played,
make
Dog.
It meta. Yeah.
Well played.
I think I actually not familiar enough with Dwarf Fortress. Jim Graham is in here, actually. I'll tell you exactly what's going on with a lot of these. But I believe that,
The game, the game randomly generates works of art, including, I think, poetry and sculptures. And of course, because it's Dwarf Fortress, what you get is a description of that thing. and they've somehow caused that to
essentially
to be very closely themed on us and
so yeah, so they've done procedurally generated, well, it sounds procedurally generated art based on dwarven interpretations of us and events. So we'll start with that, because it's the beginning of the rabbit hole. It's us and like things from the podcast. So an example would be miscellaneous decorations near the bar depicting my hot takes and times that Tom Francis failed to be a terrifying warlord. So,
I don't remember any of those times.
On the item is a rendition of Hot Takes, an image of Imesh Chris Thunderstone the Dwarf, a microphone, and takes. The takes are burning. The takes are burning the microphone. Imesh Chris Thunderstone is striking a triumphant pose. The image was commissioned by the Crowbars of Discord, a local dwarven government. It is made from iron.
I feel like the takes are burning has got to be a podcast, actually.
The takes are burning. And then, this is an exceptional gold figurine of a throne. The item is a rendition of the Second Void Empires, an image of a throne and a crown. The crown is hanging from the throne. The image was commissioned by the Crowbars of Discord. On the item is a rendition of Wartail, an image of Thimshaw Tom F. Spear the Dwarf and a scholar. Thimshaw Tom F. Spear is striking a menacing pose. Thimshaw Tom F. Spear is raising the scholar. It is made from silver. And so on. And there's fucking loads of these. let's keep going. So, and there's one dedicated to the tale of, the clash between the Hot Dukes, my Dota team, and the Jammies, the community Dota team. I'll skip ahead a bit, but on the item is a rendition of the cruel trench of sundering, an image of Jammies, Hot Dukes, and a jungle. The Jammies are fighting with the Hot Dukes. The jungle is burning. The Hot Dukes are massacring the Jammies. The Jammies are making a plaintive gesture. The Hot Dukes are striking down the Jammies. It is made from dragon bone. Which is the best thing. And then there are statues of each of us. I might just read Tom Francis's and maybe Tom Senior's because they're amazing, but yeah. The item is a rendition of Pentafrog, an image of Thimshaw Tom F. Spear the Dwarf, a trench coat, and systems. The trench coat is hanging from Thimshaw Tom F. Spear. Thimshaw Tom F. Spear is raising the systems. Thimshaw Tom F. Spear is contemplating the systems. The image was commissioned by the Crowbars of Discord, a local dwarven government.
That is so like me.
Tom Senior. The item is a rendition of Elder the Warrior, an image of Thimshaw Tom S. Elder the Dwarf, a flag, and an army. Thimshaw Tom S. the Elder is raising the flag. The army is screaming.
Amazing.
There's decorations of the recording room, which is decorated by renditions of the time I figured out what Dota heroes you'd all be. Stuff like that. And so anyway, so that's one thing. And then there are engravings in the tavern. Again, loads of them. And then there is, like things of, about the community and in jokes and stuff that's happened in the Discord community over time as well. There's loads of that. And then possibly the maddest fucking thing I've ever seen is a museum or a shrine or a temple in Dwarf Fortress, which contains artifacts with procedurally generated art names based on every single episode of the podcast up until this one we're recording now. Not only that.
Yeah,
go on, Tom.
Well, I was just going to say that this is what they're referring to when they said they had to add some words to the dictionary. So obviously they were able to spell out, there must be some way to sort of input the words you want the art to be generated from. And they were able to input all the words except those like penta and double and knob and bard. Wait, bard must have been in there, surely.
So I'll give you an example. The item is a rendition of Weird Owl the Pull Child. An image of a great horned owl man, a microphone, and an audience. The great horned owl man is embracing the microphone. The great horned owl man is striking a triumphant pose. The audience is screaming. And that is the rendition of episode 131, Weird Owl Yankovic.
That makes sense.
Yes, I remember. Yeah, I remember that. Like,
that we could go back a bit and say, On the image is a rendition of Beau Ponder's The Deep, Deep Dreams, an image of Ballista, ontology, and elves. The ballista is contemplating the ontology.
The ballista, it's not a sentence you hear every day.
The ballista is striking a triumphant pose. The ballista is shooting the elves. And that's from episode 128, I Think, Therefore, and Probably a Gun. And there are 139 of them.
Oh, my goodness. That's extraordinary.
And some of them, I think, actually reference the person who said the quote in the episode.
Mm. Wow.
So, oh God. This is an extraordinarily mad thing to have done. Kane and Vir Seraph and co. You
can't wait. I can't wait for that save file to walk around it. And watch
it's such a, yeah.
Fights,
it would be the most extraordinarily kind of like fucking Ozymandian act of hubris for us to have made.
Look upon my episodes, ye mighty. Yeah.
I feel like the only appropriate use of this save file is to bring this kingdom to complete ruin. but nonetheless.
Astonishing work.
Genuinely amazing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'm going to send this to Graham as well because, especially when the save file's available because it's like, yeah. Holy shit. We should get on with questions now, because I don't think there's a question included in this one other than, look on my mighty, my worst mighty in despair.
I wonder if you can say that. Stan Bennett writes, Dear Crumpled Cake Box, I used to play Eve a lot. I mined and grinded, that's hard to say, for ages to buy this huge, sleek Amar cruiser, my pride and joy, called Beryl. Me and Beryl flew through space, space-twatting pirates like a space Jason Statham. One day, we exploded a guy raiding asteroid miners. 10 minutes later, in the crappiest starter ship imaginable, he flew back into the system and shouted, "Lol, nice gigantic golden dildo in chat." I looked at Beryl. It was true. I immediately self-destructed and potted away in shame. Have you ever received a burn so sick in a game that you gave the other guy the win? Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been quite therapeutic.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
I admire that.
So I think I might be getting this wrong, in Andrew Groen's book, The Great Wars of, History of the Great Empires of Eve, the first Titan ever constructed in Eve, I think was called Steve. It's called Steve the Titan.
Someone fly past it and say, "Nice giant dildo," and they had to destroy it. After months of work, just dismantle it again. They were right.
I don't think any of us have an example that's anywhere near as good as that.
This is a good example of one of those questions where it's like, this amazing thing has happened to me. Has anything equally amazing happened to you? Which is like,
nope.
Actually, no. I'm trying to think. I don't know. My friends burn me in games all the time, but...
I love the idea that, like, this is not like a cool insult that this guy got in during a fight. He got killed, and he respawned 10 minutes later, came back in a different ship just to deliver that burn. Like, I thought of something to say!
It fucking worked,
nice dildo! Like, l'esprit d'escalier writ large. A galactic scale.
That's amazing. I wish I had an equally funny thing to say, but I don't.
James Thompson writes something which is not on the following page, and therefore I need to rummage through the notes to actually find it. Here we go, maybe. Is this it? Yes, okay. James Thompson writes, just listen to your answers to the question on facing overwhelming odds in video games. Tom's Supreme Commander story reminded me of a game of Forge Alliance I played co-op with a friend versus a super hard Saurian AI on a massive map. Forge Alliance being the Supreme Commander expansion. All seemed to be going well. We had built up a decent base and were progressing towards the end game. As I'm a player who plays a turtle strategy, my main responsibility was base defense while my co-op partner focused on economy and win strategy. I thought I'd held up my end of the deal pretty well until some long range scouting revealed an unforeseen threat. A spy plane gave me a momentary glimpse of a Colossus, giant robot superunit, steadily closing in on us. Upon further investigation, it became clear that it was the first of four Colossi, fast approaching our front line. Although our front line of defense was formidable, they proved too much, and after triumphantly downing the first Colossus, it keeled over, crushing most of what was left of my carefully constructed line of defense. It seems as though all was lost, as we had no other defenses in place. Without saying anything to my teammate, I made a hasty plan. Nuclear missile launch played out on the game audio, prompting my teammate to inquire in a rather panicked voice whether it was us or them. As it turns out, nukes do actually make a pretty good base defense, and watching a surviving two Klusai striding out of a mushroom cloud just before the second missile hit, punching them flat, was one of the finest moments I've seen in an RTS. And then his question is, have you ever had a wildly unconventional strategy win the day for you? I guess we've answered that to the best of our ability with the kind of, have you ever overcome massive odds? Because
I've had wildly unconventional strategies fail horribly, but yeah, and no, I can't really think of an example of them winning the day.
Yeah, that's probably why they're so unconventional. Yeah. They don't work that often. Okay, we have a couple of others. Josh Perez writes, I'm a bit afraid that my favourite genre is about to die, or at least go away for an extended length of time. Over the past decade or so, my favourite games have been the Souls series. Yes, I actually think these games are so unique in the industry, they are their own genre. It's been a golden age lately with these games, but Souls appears to be over, according to the interviews I've seen with Miyazaki, because he wants to make something different, like Armored Core. I remember when I played Demon's Souls thinking this was going to spawn an entire genre of similar deep and complex action games, but the only Souls-like games I can even think of are Lords of the Fallen, kind of meh, and Salt and Sanctuary, 2D but similar atmosphere. I was a fan of X-Wing, TIE Fighter, Wing Commander, etc., and watched that genre mysteriously vanish for years, and I'm afraid it may happen again. Do you believe there will be other games to fill this void, or is this type of game gone until From Software decides to make another Souls game, if ever?
I think From Software will definitely make another Souls game, because they like money. And they sell a lot of Souls games these days.
So they already made a Souls game that wasn't Miyazaki, right?
Dark Souls 2 was not. But he was working on Bloodborne, which is also a Souls game, basically. It's a formula. In terms of the formula, it's the same. But they're definitely moving on to something else. But if they need money in 4 or 5 years, they'll make another Souls game. And Miyazaki's actually said that if kind of other people in the company came up to him and said they wanted to make a Souls game, so they had a good idea for it, that he would be okay with that as the director of the company. So it's definitely not dead within From Software. It's just, I think Miyazaki's just gone as far as he wants to go with it and wants to do something different. In terms of derivatives, there will be derivative games like Lord of the Fallen. There'll be quite a few of them, but I'm not sure they'll ever reach the heights of Dark Souls. But we'll wait and see. I hope they do. I hope it's a genre that goes out there and gets better and better.
Yeah. An interesting thing on Idle Thumbs recently was, I can't remember which one, but one of them was saying that they had not got on with Hyperlight Drifter, and then they watched Chris and Nick's, I guess it must have been Jake by process of elimination, watched Chris and Nick playing Dark Souls 3, and after that suddenly kind of got Hyperlight Drifter and kind of got how to play it. And so I think there's something Dark Souls-y about the combat in that game. Not, like, it's certainly not sort of, like, an equal substitute or anything. But, I mean, I hear from so many people who, like, game designers and developers who love Dark Souls to death and want to make something like it, that it's hard to believe that there won't be a bunch of copycats in the indie world, at least, if not in the commercial world. You'd think they'd be in the commercial world as well. The only sort of thing is that it may be something that's kind of, like, it's hard to bottle the lightning. Like, if you want to say what's great about Dark Souls, loads of people can tell you, like, their own theories, but it probably comes down to some quite fine points of execution. I think you could make a game that's sort of superficially like Dark Souls, but has none of the appeal. I think you've got to really get some subtle stuff right.
I think the combat is one of the least kind of talked about aspects of Dark Souls and the way it works. And I've never really heard people pin down why it's so interesting for so long, even if you're using the same weapon set. And that's really where, for example, Lords of the Fallen massively falls down for me. Lords of the Fallen.
Predictably.
Yeah. Nominative determinism. In that case. Yeah, I don't know. But, you know, I mean, From Software can't be the only company that can produce that type of combat, surely.
Yeah, I watched, a bit of a let's play of a guy who completed Dark Souls 3 at level 1 without dodging or blocking. Which, it was just one of those things that sounds so absurd, you've got to see it. I feel like there's no feat that hasn't been done with Dark Souls. Like, someone's completed Dark Souls along with bongos. Now someone's done it without dodging or blocking. And for a game that's famous for its difficulty, it almost seems like there's also nothing you can't do with it. Like, there's no handicap you can give yourself that makes it impossible to complete. There's always some way of doing it. But watching this guy play,
someone will do it with a dance mat.
Yeah. Watching this guy play, like, I don't know what I expected, but it's kind of it just makes perfect sense that he would survive this. Like, the boss is doing crazy, big, sweeping damage attacks, but he's walked away a long distance or ran away. And he never actively dodges, but there's just kind of like, there's certain windows where you can run in. And as long as you kind of get actually to the boss himself, then you can get technically behind him, and then he can't quite get at you, or he initiates his attack before he can turn around, and then while he's attacking, he can't turn around, so you get your backstabs in. And it's basically the same principle as, you know, the dodge approaches.
But it requires extraordinary knowledge of boss patterns.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that apparently I watched like him fight the Lord of Cinder or something of Cinder, apparently it took him like 14 hours to do that fight, and all you see is the run where he got it right, because there's no like quick saving or anything, The run where he did it all perfectly, and it doesn't look that difficult, but what's telling about it is he just spends a lot of time just doing nothing, just keeping his distance and just not going for it, not going for it, not going for it, not going for it, not going for it. And then when he does go for it, it's obviously like he's learned through bitter experience that this is the one time you get a window where you can still get away. And when he does do it, like, I don't think he even takes damage. Like, the times when all the other bosses I watched him do, he doesn't even take a single hit.
He's level one, right?
Yeah, I guess you probably can't take a single hit.
Is he wearing any armor?
He's got bare chest. Right. I don't know what
yeah, that means. Yeah, one hit's gonna buck him up then, really.
Yeah. I had one other I was going to read, and I've cleverly lost it. It was from Aiden. Oh, yeah. Hello, Great and Crowbar. I know Chris is a self-proclaimed lore nerd, and I was wondering about his and everyone else's thoughts on the lore behind the Warcraft series. I find it is very comic booky, with characters going back and forward in time, alternate universes, villains being resurrected, etc. And although I don't usually like those kinds of stories, I very much enjoy Warcrafts. Also, what do you think about the Warcraft movie? Thanks for reading, Aiden.
I was really into it when I was a teenager. Warcraft 3 era and early WoW. I admit I haven't really been into it at all for WoW since in the last decade, pretty much, or any like the comics they've done or anything like that. I kind of get the appeal though, because it is like the thing that Blizzard are good at is it's very kind of clear and accessible and quite mechanical in the way it's executed. There's not a lot of, even now that they're introducing time travel and all that stuff to it, there's not a lot of sort of thematic complexity or character complexity to Warcraft. Everything sort of fits together kind of logically in that sort of satisfying comic book Saturday morning cartoon kind of way.
The one thing I thought was really cool about Warcraft's story was in Warcraft 3. So I never got that bit much into World of Warcraft. I played a bunch of it, but didn't really care about what quests I was doing. But in Warcraft 3, they did the thing where...
Sorry, there are infinite dogs.
We do have infinite dogs. You probably can't hear them on the podcast.
I'm going to close the window because we can hear infinite dogs.
They sound excited, to put it kindly.
Jesus.
Sorry
about that, Tom. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No worries. The first campaign in Warcraft 3 is humans, and then the next campaign is undead, and you go through each one, like there's night elves and orcs, I guess. But the way it transitions from the human campaign to the undead campaign is you, as Prince Arthas, you're trying to fight off the undead, and the undead have infected a bunch of villagers, and that's kind of like they're sort of patient zero. They are going to spread to everybody, and they've already spread this entire village, and the only way to stop it is to just kill all the villagers. And so until now, you've been doing quite heroic things and just saving the day and defeating the evil bad guys.
Right, yeah.
And then this is the first time where, like, the thing you've got to do is just murder people who've done nothing wrong, but they're infected. So you do have to murder them. If you kill them, like, right now, the infection in theory won't spread. And so you just murder all the villagers. And some of your erstwhile companions show up and like, what the fuck are you doing, Arthas? This is not okay. You can't kill them. And you try and explain to them, no, we've got to kill them because of the infection. Mm. And you do it. And no one understands, and you get completely exiled from the Alliance, and everyone hates you, and you become like, they all treat you like a monster, and then you just become that monster, and then you become the leader of the undead, basically.
Well,
I can't remember exactly what happens, like how you get ingratiated with them, whether they sort of kind of,
you find a really mean sword,
right,
and then
that
you
sense.
Kill your dad with it.
Yeah, but that was like one of the only times where you sort of like switch sides for a pretty good reason. Like, the thing you did was had to be done. It was ugly, but you had to be done. And then the fact that people hated you for it made sense. Like, you, even as you're doing it and you know it should be done, you think, yeah, I see how this looks bad. I know why you're going to, like, ostracize me for this. And then once you are ostracized, maybe, like, actually leading the opposition doesn't make that much sense, but you can see how someone can become corrupted from that.
Vanilla WoW had really good, I mean, later WoW may well have done as well, really good environmental storytelling in that regard, because one of the reasons it was exciting way back when I don't think people were excited about World of Warcraft because it was going to reinvent the MMO or define the MMO like it subsequently did, but because it was the first time that entire world was in a game, and it's sort of still impressive that when it launched, it was huge geographically. Like, vanilla WoW is fucking massive, and it was the first time that entire world, with maybe some exceptions, had been presented as kind of a single contiguous landmass where you could run everywhere without loading screens, and all, like, those villages from missions in Warcraft 3 are in it. There were some bits that you couldn't get to in the launch game, but one of the coolest little bits of environmental storytelling in vanilla WoW is there's a cutscene where Arthas kills his father, the king, and, like, in this big circular throne room, it's old Blizzard CGI, and that circular throne room is sort of in, you pass through it as the entryway to the undead undercity, because the undead undercity is built into the ruins of that castle city thing. And if you stand in there for, like, as you walk through the whole place, the idea is the whole place is haunted to all hell because it's like the undead sort of citadel. There are whispers and stuff in the shadows. If you stand in the throne room for long enough, you realize that the whispers are the audio of that cutscene.
Oh, no.
Well, I hear it really. Because I always remember that the line is like, what are you doing, Arthas? And he says, succeeding you, and then stabs his father with a sword. And if you listen really carefully when you're standing near the throne, you'll hear, what are you doing, Arthas? Like, and it's just little details like that, which are great. Like, the underlying story is not dazzlingly original, or the characters are not dazzlingly, you know, multidimensional necessarily, but has these big emblematic moments that then they do very intelligent things with, I think. I think latterly, I wouldn't necessarily know, because I think, like all big comic book universes, it's probably gotten a little bit convoluted, but.
There is a power to a story that unfolds over a decade as well. So that you kind of stay with, and you have that history with it, and those distant events are distant for you as well. And that creates kind of the expanse of the makes the story feel bigger than it is, even if it is about big kind of emblematic characters.
Yeah.
And that's about it for questions.
If that's all the questions we have time for, then that is all the podcast we do.
That's how the saying goes.
If you'd like to do us a question for a future podisode, then you can send it via the electric mail to questions@crakencrowbar.com. You could also leave a question on the forum at crakencrowbar.com/forum, where you'll also find a thread for discussing this episode. You can also discuss the episode on Discord, whence mad monolithic projects come. And you can find a link for Discord either in the show notes for this episode, which are on the website, or on the sidebar of the website, down on the right-hand side, I think. You can watch this episode on YouTube, I guess, which I keep forgetting to mention all the time. We have a YouTube channel for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. I, Chris Thurston, am at C Thurston, CTHURSTEN. He, Tom Francis, is
at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
And I, the Tom Senior of Elder Death Dragonbone, at PCG Ludo, LUDO.
The army is screaming.
The army is screaming.
And this podcast was commissioned by the crowbars of Discord.
Thanks for listening, everybody.